We're working our way through this all-in series. We started with Noah and how God complicated and inconvenienced his life as he went all in and he built this giant boat, this ark, and he took care of all those animals. Last week, we looked at Abraham and Isaac and how they put it all on the altar. And in Isaac's case, literally all of himself on the altar. If you have your Bibles, if you would turn over to Joshua chapter 14, and I'll give you a little bit to get there, and I'll keep talking with you. It sounds really, really hot for some reason. Maybe it's just me. Hopefully, as we've been going through this series, God has been speaking with you and dealing with you a little bit. The Israelites, they have wandered in the wilderness for some 40 years after 400 years of slavery. In Egypt. At one point, Moses, he sent out these 12 spies to go and look at the promised land. And for 40 days, they're traveling, they're wandering around through the promised land. One of them, his name was Caleb. And Caleb comes back with this positive report. He silences the people and he says to them, "Let's go take possession of the promise that God has given to us." But 10 out of the 12 spies, they come back with this bad report and they say, "We seem like grasshoppers in the eyes of the giants we saw in the land." See, they failed to claim the promise and an entire generation died. But years later, God gives them a second chance. Aren't you glad that God gives us second chances? Now what you have to do is you have to, from that point, you have to fast forward some 45 years. Caleb is the oldest man in Israel by a long shot. His entire generation has died off, and according to tradition, Joshua was probably less than half his age. Joshua may have been around 17 years old. When he went in, it was one of the 12 spies that went into the promised land. Caleb was 40, and so now he is 85 years young. And that's where we pick up. Joshua, chapter 14, beginning at verse 6. Now the people of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, son of Nephahena, however you want to say that. Man, I always get a different version for it. And the Kenizzite said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God at Kadesh Barnea, about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions." Now, I understand it's hard to live by your convictions. It's very difficult. But I believe living by your convictions is part of what it means to go all in. You cannot compromise in your conviction, in your relationships, in your occupation, in your finances. You just don't compromise because your convictions are the things that God is leading you to, that God is telling you to do, and you have to stick with those. The first part of verse 8, Caleb continues, says, "But my fellow Israelites who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt in fear." Really, the difference between going all in and just holding out is this. It really comes down to this. Are you going to allow fear to dictate your decisions, or are you going to allow faith to dictate your decisions? See, that's the difference. That's the difference between entering the promised land and claiming the promises of God and experiencing the miracles, or just spending the rest of your life on the other side of the Jordan River, wondering, where is God? That's the difference. Second half of verse 8. Caleb continues and he says, "I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day, Moses swore to me, the land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance, and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses while Israel moved about in the wilderness. So here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I am just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now, I like this. I don't know about you, but I think this is good right here. Ashley Montague, she said, I want to die young at a ripe old age. See, what we have here in Caleb is we have a young man who is in an 85-year-old body. But what makes this so profoundly amazing is the connective proposition, the word as. In the Hebrew language, it means identical to. See, he could bench press as much at 85 as he could at 40. That's what it means. It means he was really as strong at 85 as he was at 40. Now, I don't know if any of you ever watched the Rocky movies, any of the Rocky movies. They're now all the way into Creed number 2, which is just getting ready to come out. But in Rocky number 5, Sylvester Stallone, I mean, this must have been like 100 years ago, but Sylvester Stallone, he was 60 years old, and his body, it was cut. He was built. How do you maintain it for that long? How do you stay like that? There is no way I can lift or do as much now as I did 2 years ago or 3 years ago. This here is an 85-year-old man in Caleb that you just don't want to mess with. I wish we had an audio tape as he's delivering the speech, as he's talking, because I cannot even begin to do it justice. Just imagine the conviction that is coming out in his voice when he's saying this. And this is his Braveheart moment. This is his gladiator moment. And he says in verse 12, now give me this hill country that the... Let me try this again. Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. Just imagine him standing there with conviction and saying that out loud. Doesn't that just send tingles down your spine, get you going? And he continues and said, you yourself heard then that the Anakites were there, and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said. And then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. Caleb, he was all in. Now, we've been talking about what it means to go all in. And the truth of it is, I think it looks like different things to different people at different times in different places. It looks like Noah, in the middle of a desert, building this giant boat and collecting all of these animals. It looks like Abraham putting Isaac on the altar. And in this case, it looks like an 85-year-old Caleb saying, give me the hill country. Now, here's what I love about Caleb. It's not just the fact that he was all in when he was 40 years old. But he was still all in when he was 85. Now, I understand our demographics in this building and in our place. See, Caleb, he didn't retire at 65. He didn't decide to play it safe at 70. He didn't just go out and play shuffleboard at 75. And if he had the opportunities available to him that we do today, I can just imagine him going and skydiving at the age of 80. Maybe at 81, climbing Mount Everest. At 83, he's hiking the Pacific Rim Trail, running an Ironman triathlon at 84. And here, at the age of 85, he says, let's start a war. Let's go after the hill country. See, I love that about Caleb. I love the spirit of Caleb and just his get-go attitude. You know what the simple answer is? The reason why he was so vigorous at 85 as he was when he was 40 is because of his faith. It never diminished. In fact, his faith grew. It grew stronger over time. And it was that faith that animated him, that energized him, that kept him going in a way that I pray that we can experience. I pray that God would give us, each one of us, the spirit of Caleb. But why did Caleb pick Hebron? I think he picked it for a couple of reasons. For starters, it was the highest place, the highest town in all of Palestine. Almost 1,000 meters, which is 300 feet above the Mediterranean Sea. Which tells me that it was the high ground. Which means it would have been the most difficult place to attack. And the most difficult place to conquer. And I think that this guy, Caleb, who doesn't like the path of least resistance, he doesn't even know what that is. It's not in his vocabulary. It is not in his mindset. Give me the hill country. Now, it also says that the Anakites lived there. They were giants, this giant race of men and women as well. And Caleb says, give me the hill country. I think because he wanted the sheer joy and the privilege of the most difficult battle so that he could experience God receiving the most glory. See, that is the spirit of Caleb. Now, one footnote, I think it's very significant. According to a Jewish rabbi, when Caleb was in the promised land looking and scouting it out, there is one point where he left the other 11 spies and he went off on his own to Hebron because Hebron was where his ancestors from 500 years earlier were buried. Their grave sites were there. Abraham, he spent much of his life in Hebron. And according to this tradition, Caleb went to Hebron and he fell prostrate on the ground. And he prayed on those graves where his ancestors were buried. Can I ask you a question? Do you think that was a powerful moment for Caleb? Years ago, Lisa and I, we were still living in Capitola in Santa Cruz. And Lisa was off at a women's retreat in Diamond Arrow and there, and she was coming home, and it was a Sunday. And I get a phone call, and the call is from Guam. They tell me that Lenny's husband has passed away. He was in an accident, fishing accident, and he passed away. And I had to make a decision. Do I tell Lisa she's driving home? Do I tell her while she's driving home about this, or do I wait? Well, I decided I would wait. I didn't want Lisa to be driving home by herself and to hear this news and have to drive home for 3 or 4 hours knowing that and with that. It was a Sunday evening, and we had Bible study church that night. And so we get to church, and Lisa shows up, and I tell her about it. I tell her about Lenny's husband passing away, what had happened. And it was a very tough service. Very, very hard to be there and stuff like that, wanting to be back on Guam to help and to do things. And that night we sang a song, and the song was Arms of Love. To this very day, every time I hear that song, my mind goes back, it races back to that moment. Today, worship team, thank you very much. You sing the song, Beautiful Name. Man, how we cannot be moved by songs like that, I don't know. Such a beautiful, such a wonderful, such a powerful name. Are there songs that we sing, when you hear it, your mind goes back to a time, maybe it was a tough time, maybe it was a glorious time, and you just hang on to it, and it just means so much to you. I mean, how often did Caleb go back in his mind to that moment when he falls prostrate on the ground and he prays over the graves that God would give him the promised land, the land that was promised to him. Imagine the heartache. When he is silenced, when he silences the people and he tells them, we can surely do this. The Lord is with us. We can claim this promise. And how devastatingly disappointing it was for him. Then it was 45 years that he had to pay the punishment for those who did not have the faith. But he never gave up on the promise. That promise, it was in his heart, and it grew. And finally, some 45 years later, with this 45 years of passion that is pent up inside of him, that has been building up inside of him, and he says, give me the hill country. I am going back to the place where I fell prostrate and I prayed that God would keep his promise. Now, by the way, Hebron is where Caleb's descendant, a young shepherd by the name of David, he would be anointed king of Judah. And where for 7.5 years he would make it the capital city until it was eventually moved to Jerusalem. You see, David, he doesn't have a capital city unless this guy named Caleb says, I'm all in. Do you see the history that we are a part of? It goes all the way back to Noah. It goes back to Abraham. It goes back to Caleb. If Caleb is not all in, they never claim the promised land. They never get to experience the miracles that God does. And that brings us to Richmond Community Church. Several members of the Portland, Oregon, Woodstock Church of God, they lived in the Richmond area. And ever since their pastor, who was E.H. Arndt, had his home in the Richmond area, they often talked about the possibility of starting a church there. After some time under Pastor Arndt's leadership, it was decided to find a suitable place to rent until they could see a way to build. The opportunity, it came up. When the old St. David's Episcopal Church was available for rent, get this, $10 a month. So they began meeting on May 30th, 1937. They met there until that building was sold in 1939. So the congregation, they had to move to Waverly Hall, which was on Clinton Street. It was a large room that was above a tavern, and you got to it through a stairway. Rent, again, was only $10 a month. The first meeting there was on May 7th, 1939. You see, if these people are not all in, that church doesn't even begin. On April 1st, 1940, two lots were purchased on the corner of 40th and Division. Permits were purchased and a foundation for the church building was started on October 1941. The congregation, they moved into an unfinished building on June 27th, 1942. Sheets were hung where the windows would later be located. The women, they would help to put lath up on the walls, and they would come in and help to varnish the floors when they were ready. When the winter rains came and filled this pit that was dug for the furnace, Pastor Arndt would show up on Saturday nights, and he would bail out the water so that they could start the furnace on Sunday morning. Nora Arndt, she sold Christmas cards and other kinds of cards. Get this, Miss Mabel Barkhurst, she sold a cow for her special contribution. And Mr. McNary, he donated time and money to set out trees and planted the lawn. You see, none of that takes place if these people are not all in. Tim, go ahead. The dedication of the building was on Sunday, November 14th, 1943. Pastor Arndt and Donald Smith were given special recognition because they had done most of the work that previous year. A mortgage burning service was held on Easter Sunday, April 1st, 1945. Pastor Arndt resigned April 6, 1946. Pastor Roper, he preached his very first message on April 28, 1946, that same year. The church continued to grow and grew, so much so that plans were made to expand the church. And in July of 1950, work was started to help upgrade this church, but also for those of you sitting here, you can look out that way and to add the Sunday school classrooms, the wing over there. Bill Carroll, he was the construction foreman, and all who could drive a nail straight were invited to help. The entire church, endowed with only the riches of Christ, gave of their very best of time and of money. Many college students who were working to support their families and trying to keep up their studies, they would spend every spare moment possible on this building. The men of the church, they would come evenings after work, week after week. And the women, they would come in on Saturday and clean and sweep everything and get it ready for a Sunday morning service. See, none of that happens if these people are not all in. Pastor Roper, he resigned in 1958, and the Ely's were called to take over the work. There was a special meeting on December 8th, 1965. A decision was made to begin the West Side Project. It was a church of God that would be located in Tigard, Oregon. Early in 1969, the Ely's resigned. And in the summer of 1970, Dr. Eugene Conover, he was called to come and to be the new pastor. In 1973, a decision was made to stop trying to relocate and to accept the challenge to serve this community indefinitely. And that is when the name was changed to Richmond Community Church. See, none of that happens if the people aren't all in. During the years of the 70s and the 80s, there was a bus ministry, a thriving bus ministry. Many hours were spent devoting time and material to that outreach. That is where our history book ends. So what I've done is I have asked Don to come up and to share with you from that point to wherever he gets to.
Partially due to Pastor Ely's working with, having a working relationship with Pacific Bible College, which was what is now Warner Pacific, he worked in and was instrumental in many young couples coming to the college to study for Christian ministry. They worked in many areas in our church here. We were known as a sending church. To this day, there are many former Richmondites scattered across the nation and even in around parts of the world. It was under Pastor Conover's leadership that began the bus ministry. Many hours were spent during the bus ministry years, requiring the all-in dedication of many people of all ages. This ministry had people working as bus captains who visited families on Saturday to make sure that they were going to be coming the next day. There were those who called on Sunday mornings with reminders to let them know that the bus would be around to pick up their child. There were those who rode along to maintain order by leading and singing or storytelling. We even had one person, his part of the ministry was that he would go out and stand on a street corner somewhere where he knew the bus would be coming by, he would get on. And one story that stands out was he was, I forget what he was dressed in clothes-wise, but he had this like seaweed all over him to tell the story of Jonah. Anyway, then there were those involved that were involved in maintaining our buses. The church had four buses, used, old buses, but they were there were many that were involved in the maintenance of them so that on Sunday we'd have enough buses running to operate on our three routes that we had. On one Sunday morning, in particular, our attendance reached the all-time high of 309. 309. We had the main service here downstairs in the basement. We had our children's church, which was much on the order of what we did here, except at their level. And that Sunday morning, they were down there, and at the end of the service, they had them come up. They filled the narthex. They filled the aisles. I don't know what they'd have done if they'd have been here with for the fire department, because we were only authorized for 227.
They don't work on Sunday.
As time passed and people left to work in other places, the number began to fall. As the congregation aged and fewer families were involved, the number of people declined. Since numbers were fewer and some were growing discouraged by the lack of parent involvement or response, and because of heavy wear and tear on the building, the bus ministry was phased out. Even as the numbers had begun to decline, Pastor Conover had a vision of the church growing. He, along with the few of the people in the church, began a regular walk, prayer walk, around the block right next door here to us. And they were dedicating themselves to purchasing the properties as they became available. Time after time, although it seemed a hopeless goal, God provided the right person or circumstances to allow the purchase. We now enjoy the fruit of their dedication. On a trip to Southern California, Dr. Conover was caught in a dust storm while at a service station getting fuel. He began to struggle with a terrible viral lung infection from which he never recovered. For the next several months, he tried to maintain his leadership with the help of others to fill the pulpit, finally forming a plan with Dr. John Good, the pastor of Holiday Park Church, that Dr. Good would come over to Richmond for our service, which was at 9:30 in the morning, 9:30 till 10:30, then quickly go to Holiday Park for their 11 o'clock service. This plan allowed us to have some continuity and lasted for about a year, thanks to Dr. Good's gracious assistance. Pastor Conover realized that in all probability he would never recover to that point, that he could resume the pastorate and advise us to begin praying about seeking another spiritual leader. Our attendance had dwindled to the low 20s, the youngest in their late 40s. Bill and Virginia Martin and Carol and myself had the task of finding a leader. We called Sam Dunbar, who was the state coordinator, to meet with us, which he did, thinking we were asking about the process of disbanding. But to his surprise, we wanted guidance for going forward. The next part borders on the miraculous. God was working on several parts all at once. The LaFonts, that is Carol and I, each had separately and were thinking about who we might call, and the thought came of contacting Pastor Doug Bolt. He had been music minister at Rockwood Church of God for several years, then moved to Fairfield, California, where for almost 2 years he had been their music minister. He had never been a senior pastor, and we had very little money. Impossible, huh? Well, our daughter, Barbara, was going to visit the Bolts, So we asked if she would just mention our common thoughts to see if he would be interested in considering the possibility. Unbeknownst to us, it turned out that Portland Christian School had been in contact with Doug to see if he would be interested in returning to teach here in Portland again. The Bolts prayed about it, and since they would be in Portland for the Western Area Regional Meeting, they agreed to come speak to us at that time. They were also able to talk to the people at Portland Christian about the possibilities which they had offered. We, the church here, voted the next week to ask them to come as our pastors. They accepted and arrived to minister in August of 1996. Pastor Doug and his wife and their two young children brought a new spark to our body. His musical gift was a true blessing, and their coming attracted friends from the area, some who had formerly worshipped here, and some new to our body. The style of music changed from being mostly hymns to a more contemporary tone. We were able to enjoy choirs, coffee house fellowships, and drama productions. The Bolts were our pastors for about 10 years, and their family grew from 4 to 7 while they were here. When Pastor Doug resigned, our pulpit was filled by Joel Collier, Pastor Frank Clore, Pastor Val Watkins, and others as our search committee prayerfully sought another spiritual leader. After considering resumes, Jeff McCoy was called and came as our pastor for about 5 months. Even though his tenure was brief, he instituted a change to an eldership and trustee style of organization, which we still employ. Through the years, there have been those who have stepped up to the call of leading our youth. I'm sure I don't remember them all, but Steve and Linda Graham were leaders when our girls first were of age to be involved. Then Teresa Pullen, now Teresa Jenny, and Wanda Plank led the group. Danelle Stevens also was one of the leaders. There were leaders before these that I've mentioned, and then after Danelle Stevens, she felt called to work, I believe, in the Philippines
mission.
As a mission trip there. And when she did that, then our own pastor, Val and Lisa Watkins, stepped in and led the youth group. Under their leadership, the youth group grew to around 30 youth. Pastor Val, while spending time away in the Philippines visiting Lisa's parents, dedicated time to prayer about our request to be the lead pastor. He agreed to a 3-year commitment. We are pleased that God's plans for him have not expired, even though those 3 years have long since passed. Of course, and I don't know about that. You know, God says a day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day, so who knows how long they'll still be with us serving. The brevity of Pastor Jeff's leadership came as a bit of a shock to us all, and with much prayer and persuasion, our youth pastor, Pastor Val, was persuaded to temporarily add pastoral leadership of the church to his heart's call as a youth.
Thank you, Don. Now, I asked Don to come up and share that with you because, as many as you know, and he doesn't really necessarily like to accept the fact, he is the patriarch of this congregation, of this group of people. A very long history. And if these people aren't all in, none of this exists. We are not even here today. Lisa and I first started attending here in 1998, and Pastor Doug asked if I would be willing to come on staff. I was already licensed at the time as a minister, and I took up missions and small groups, and did that until 2000 when Danelle decided she wanted to go serve on the missions field. And I've been working as the youth pastor ever since. In December 31st of 2006, Pastor Doug, he resigned, and his family, actually, he preached the morning message, and they drove away and they left. We went through a search of trying to find a pastor, and we wanted somebody who was young and vibrant and would lead us, and that led us to Pastor Jeff, and we asked him to come, and he preached his very first message on August 19th, 2007. It was during Christmas time that he and his family, they went down and visited his parents down in California, came back and gave us the news that he was resigning. And on January 1st, 2008, he preached his farewell message. It was kind of a farewell prayer. If you want, you can listen to it. It is actually online, and I listened to it yesterday. It was during that time, 2008, until about May, where we were in the search and trying to figure out what to do. The church had been struggling for many years financially. Under Pastor Doug's leadership, we had gone up to where we actually went to two services. We had two services going in the morning. We sold a house and we built an elevator. We had an elevator put in so that people could get down into the basement of the fellowship hall if they wanted to. We were so strapped for money, we actually turned the elevator off because we could not afford to keep it up and to get it maintained to where it was a safe level. The church struggled and struggled financially. And part of that, I think, may have led to the demise of why Pastor Doug was here, because there was always this battle of trying to pay and trying to keep the bills and trying to do both, and we just couldn't do both. When we called Pastor Jeff, we told him we don't have a lot, but we know that we can grow with you. And there were a lot of things he brought to Synergy and a lot of things he wanted to do. And I think maybe we were being still too much. As Frankie actually said earlier, we actually came to a complete stop. So we're not going anywhere until we get a lead pastor, and when he was ready to lead us, we could not get going. There were other things involved, and so Pastor Jeff left, and we were in shock. What are we going to do now? And we don't have any money. We don't have anything. We have a lot of assets, buildings and stuff like that. A lot of them are run down and stuff like that. They're hard to maintain. And so as a congregation in May of 2008, we went to the Philippines to see Lisa's parents and to celebrate their wedding anniversary. And I asked several groups of people, will you pray with me about this time while I'm gone, on where God's going to lead us and what God's going to do for us and how he's going to lead us. And I came back and spoke with the leadership, and the decision was made for 3 years I'll help. And we'll work on trying to get this group financially stable and take care of the finances and stuff. Tim, go ahead. This is a little bit of what the church looked like. That is basically this wall right here out there on the outside. Really run down. It's taped up and they're starting to paint it. A decision was made to upgrade the front of the church. Some people walked by and didn't even know that this was a church or that people would meet here because everything was so run down. In 2009, we started a remodeling project on the front, and the youth showed up and they helped to demolish the front of it, and we put the rock in place. The youth group came and did that. And then Don and I, actually Jason came in and put the metal cap on. You can go out there and look at it. He was responsible for doing that. And then Don and I remodeled the front of it. We got Brent Hofer to come in and take care of the painting of the rest of the building. Decisions were made to continually try to upgrade. We added front glass doors. Those went in 2011. We've added new windows. In 2012 and 2013, the bathrooms over here were remodeled and a new flooring went down. In 2015, we did an interior remodel of the Carruthers house, in which we were able to rent it out and get it at more of a fair market value. We took the division house, which is this one here, in 2015. We remodeled that one. And then Kelly and Mark moved in, and they've been renting it from us since. We've gotten to the point, I think, where we are financially stable. We may not be doing great, but we're at least financially stable. Tim, go ahead and throw the next one up there, just so you can all see. This is the front of the church after it was done. If you notice on the side, the fence is not up yet. The front doors are actually not on, the new front doors. See, God has been good to us. He always has. And even at a point, before Pastor Doug came, when there were only 22 people meeting here, a remnant, and the association thought for sure the doors were going to be closed. Those people, they had a calling, and they knew that God had a purpose for this church. What is it? to serve God. I don't know all the directions. I know what God is telling me, and I know what my all-in is all about. But where is God leading you? What is God telling you? What we're going to do is the worship team is going to lead us in a song. And we are getting ready to go into our business meeting. And this is as graceful as the transition as I can get it. We're going to go right after the song. We're going to go straight into our business meeting. Because I believe our business is actually part of our worship as well. If you have somewhere you have to go, if you're not comfortable being in the business meeting, then during the song, you can gracefully get up and leave. No judgment, nothing like that. During the business meeting, we will talk about next year and where we're headed as a church, hopefully, and some of the other stuff. So, worship team, go ahead.